Welcome to Frenzy on the Podcast, right here on Movie City News. I'm Noah Forrest, your podcast host. Today we got Scott Z. Burns on the line. He is the screenwriter of The Informant! With Matt Damon, directed by Steven Soderbergh. Really good movie. I liked it a lot. He was also a producer on Inconvenient Truth. He wrote and directed a movie called PU-239 with Patty Considine, which is a very underrated film. And I'm excited to talk to him about all sorts of things. So let's talk to Scott. I really liked The Informant a lot. It completely subverted my expectations, and that's always a good thing. And I think the question that's on everyone's mind is, whose decision was it to add the exclamation point to the title?
It was pretty much Warner Brothers and Steven. I think, you know, what we were trying to do was prepare people for sort of a comedy. And, you know, mm-hmm. So we looked at Mars Attacks and decided they have an exclamation point.
Yeah.
And I went with that.
More to the point is, you know, is if you always envision The Informant as something more humorous or satirical. I mean, did you ever even consider writing it as a corporate thriller? I mean, I would imagine it would sound kind of, it would seem kind of silly to watch it played straight because, you know, so much of it is kind of ridiculous.
Yeah, well, that's sort of how we felt. I mean, in part, you know, the environment when Steven and I started working on the movie was he had done Aaron Brockovich a couple of movies before,
mm-hmm.
and Michael Mann had done The Insider, and so we really didn't want to make that kind of a movie because, you know, Steven and I both thought The Insider was a really good movie.
Yeah.
And so in part it was that, but what you just said is also really true. There's just no way to tell the story without, you know, without bursting into laughter.
Yeah.
Because of, you know, Whitaker's antics. I mean, there's, you know, the scene in the movie where he says, I'm Special Agent 0014. I wish I could take credit for writing that, but I didn't. I mean, that really happened.
Yeah.
And you can't imagine dropping that scene in the middle of The Insider. So,
yeah. Well, I think,
you know, the story itself sort of cries out for that.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, part of the thing that you did so well in writing it is picking out the right pieces. You know, I think whenever you're making a movie that's based on real events, you know, the biggest part of your job, I would imagine, is to sort through the material and figure out, okay, you know, which parts do I use and which parts do I throw away? I was wondering if you had any parts of the Kurt Eichenwald book or parts that you did, that you researched, that you kind of wish you could have fit in there.
Yeah, I mean, definitely. I mean, thank you for saying that, and I think that is sort of the big task in any kind of adaptation of a real event is, you know, as it turns out, art, you know, if art, all art does is imitate real life, art's going to be pretty boring.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think you do have to edit what went on. I think, you know, for me, the moments that I missed that were hard to integrate into a comedy, you know, at one point Whitaker, you know, actually at two points, Whitaker tried to kill himself.
Mm-hmm.
And we actually shot a scene where that happens. And it really made it hard to come back to the comic tone. And we even shot it in sort of a comic way, but it's pretty dark.
Yeah.
And it's sort of, you know, made for an uncomfortable moment. And I think Steven's ambition was to make, you know, a comedy in the spirit of a Richard Lester comedy.
Mm-hmm.
And there wasn't really, you know, when you're going to commit to that kind of tone, you've really got to go all the way.
Yeah.
So the suicide was one of those moments. There's another moment which we also shot where you begin to see sort of the more angry, depressive side of Whitaker's bipolar syndrome,
mm-hmm.
where he's blowing a leaf in the yard in the middle of the night.
I read about that, actually. I think it was on the Wikipedia page for him, where it talked about that, and I was like, wow, that's very bizarre.
And Matt did an incredible job with the scene. Again, you know, I think what Steven decided in the edit room was that to keep the comedy moving along, you know, and to not upset the tone of the film,
mm-hmm.
we had to sort of dispense with some of those moments.
Yeah. Well, I mean, how was the relationship between, you know, you and Steven Soderbergh and Matt Damon? I mean, these are two kind of very passionate individuals, and Soderbergh especially has become kind of one of the most interesting filmmakers working today because he's, you know, this auteur, yet none of his films kind of look alike. And I was wondering, you know, what was the process like of working with the two of them? How inclusive was it?
It's great. I mean, you know, Steven and I are working on another movie together. And I started The Informant 7 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, since then, I wrote and directed a movie that Steven produced for me. Steven had me help out on Ocean's 12, which is how I first met Matt.
Mm-hmm.
And Matt and I became close, because at that point I'd actually already finished a draft of The Informant, and Matt had committed, and so I was invited to write The Bourne Ultimatum, mainly because Matt and I had, you know, developed kind of a working relationship based on The Informant. And so we all, you know, the movie, even though it's coming out now, it actually gave me a lot of opportunities because, you know, the three of us had worked on this together over the 7 years. And, you know, Matt, you know, was nothing but supportive the entire time. I mean, he loved, you know, the conceit of the voiceover was something he really took to instantly. He understood sort of what my ambitions are with that, and so did Steven. So
mm-hmm.
It's been really great. And, you know, Steven has a history of being very loyal and inclusive of his writer on all of his movies. And, you know, I feel the same way about his work that you do. He's like, you know, the one guy who really, you know, has made so many movies and so many different kinds of movies and isn't afraid, you know, to fail and goes to a different place, you know, almost based on whatever he did before. You know, he talks about The Informant as in some respects being informed by the fact that he had just come off of Che, which was a really heavy, you know, exhaustive kind of experience. And so when he went into this movie, you know, he wanted to have fun. And I think the movie benefits from that.
Certainly, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think there's, you mentioned the voiceovers, and I think that's one of the most interesting parts of the film, especially because I'm kind of a sucker for voiceovers in general. I kind of always have enjoyed the interior monologue of a particular character. Did you find it made it easier to tell the story, or is there kind of more pressure to make the voiceover vital and important?
Well, you know, our voiceover is, you know, is kind of different from a lot of voiceovers. You know, I know that the other day I was on a panel and Nick Kazan was on the panel and he was talking about how, you know, Paul Schrader had told him years ago that the voiceover, you know, you shouldn't be saying what you're seeing. And I think in any situation with voiceover, but in our movie, you know, my ambition was to create, you know, an unreliable narrator on film. And unlike, you know, Verbal Kent, who is an unreliable narrator, I guess, of a sort in...
Certainly, yeah.
You know, or Tyler Durden in Fight Club, you know, Whitaker is sort of an unreliable narrator who's out of control. And that for me was a really fun place to take the character, because it was a way of taking this convention and subverting it, because normally when we hear, you know, a voiceover, we assume some omniscience, and, mm-hmm. you know, the interesting thing about Whitaker is he wouldn't tell you the truth, I think, even if he knew what it was at any given moment.
I think the fascinating thing is that he, in his voiceovers, it's not that he's lying in all the voiceovers, it's that what he's saying has almost nothing to do with the action. It's, you know, like, instead of thinking about what's going on, he's wondering about how polar bears first discovered that their noses were black. And
yeah, I mean, I hope when people, you know, if you look at the movie a second or third time, you begin to find the connections. But, I mean, part of being bipolar is, you know, there's a phenomenon called tangentiality. And right. Whitaker really, you know, that's what I was trying to get at. And so, in a sense, you know, when Whitaker's talking about a polar bear and about being disguised, he's talking about himself and, you know, and what's going on, but only in this, you know, very removed, sort of disconnected way. And so, you know, that for me was, you know, when we started the process, Stephen had said to me, go and write a version of this that only you could write. Go and find a way in that no one else would find, which is really an amazingly inviting piece of direction from somebody. And so for me, it was to sort of write Whitaker from the inside out.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned, you know, the usual suspects and Verbal Kent, and you had mentioned The Insider. Were there any other films that influenced you during the writing of this movie, even in just the way that you would write it to not be like a certain movie?
You know, Stephen had encouraged me to watch The Knack by Richard Lester. And I watched it, and I don't know if you've seen The Knack.
I haven't.
It's really interesting, but it's a pretty cool movie, but it's really out there. And I asked Stephen when we were done, I was like, why did you want me to watch The Knack? And he's like, I don't remember telling you that. So, the unreliable narrator thing, I think, as much came out of literature for me as it did for movies.
Any particular books?
You know, but Notes from Underground was one. Mm-hmm. The American was another. There's an old Melville book called The Confidence Man. That was kind of interesting to me. But, you know, Stephen and I had talked about the unreliable narrator in literature, and felt that this was a really great opportunity to apply it to film in a way that we hadn't really seen it done before.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting because, you know, film is usually a medium in which all of the essential action is usually seen in one way or another. And it's interesting because you're seeing the film through Mark Whitaker's eyes, you kind of, you don't realize that he's doing things outside of the scenes that you're seeing. Which I think makes it fascinating when it comes up later that, like, oh, he was doing this the whole time. It's like, well, that's what I get for just, you know, listening to him and believing him.
Which to some degree, and I've, you know, we've heard from people who were in Whitaker's life while this was going on, was their experience of him. Mm-hmm. That he was a guy who would be sitting there, you know, talking about, you know, biotech stuff or other kinds of things and you know, going off on tangents. And that their experience was he seemed like this very affable, you know, almost nerdy scientist guy who'd kind of turned into a businessman. And they had no idea and no concept, in spite of the fact that he was driving around in a new car all the time, that he was embezzling all of this money.
Yeah.
And I think that's, you know, that was his great disguise, was he was, you know, this smiling, happy, you know, man living out in Milwaukee, Illinois, who you would never think of as a kind of master criminal.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the other thing is that the lies that he tells, at least in the film, are so... it's almost like, why would he lie about that? Like the being adopted thing.
Yeah.
And he has this reason behind it, but it's like, why? Why would he do that?
Yeah, when you begin to think about it, you know, what better cover is there for a criminal than to be an FBI informant?
Mm-hmm.
Although Whitaker sort of, when initially he went undercover, he didn't do a lot of embezzling. Towards the end, as the case was coming to a close, is when he did a lot of, you know, his sort of kickback schemes. And, you know, his rationale was that he was writing his own, you know, severance at that point, that he had to commit, you know, those frauds because he needed to take care of himself and his family. What's odd about that claim is also at the same time he was telling people that he thought he would end up running the company.
Yeah.
So even that, you know, is this unbelievably contradictory thing.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to talk a little bit about your first film as well, because PU 239, because I thought it was such an underrated film. And
you just made my day.
Well, I think it just kind of got lost in the shuffle somewhere. You know, I remember watching it and being like, wow, this is really, you know, fascinating. And then I didn't really read much about it after that. And I wanted to know how you became attracted to that particular story.
You know, that one, it's funny because there's a weird similarity in terms of how I came in contact with the source material of both of them. You know, the informant, I first heard the story on This American Life,
mm-hmm.
On Ira Glass's show, and then I went and explored the option on the book and took it to Stephen and pitched it there. PU-239 was in a collection of short stories by an author named Ken Kalfas, and I had seen the book reviewed in the New York Times, and I happened to be in a bookstore and pick up the book, and it was the first story in the collection, and I'd always sort of had a fascination with Russia.
Mm-hmm.
I was drawn to it for, you know, for the reasons that it was both comic and tragic and had these two amazingly different characters that sort of ended up needing each other, you know, kind of almost in a Midnight Cowboy sort of way.
Yeah.
And that, you know, I sort of wanted, I guess, in some ways to make a Russian Midnight Cowboy.
Now that you mention it, I kind of see it. that's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it became sort of a very willing repository for, you know, my fascination with that movie and with Dog Day Afternoon,
mm-hmm.
and some other things that, you know, are kind of are in there. I think it was the first PU-239 is the first screenplay I ever wrote, and I didn't know that you weren't supposed to put funny scenes next to serious scenes.
Yeah. Well, I think that makes it, what, you know, so interesting. And I think that Patty Considine is such a talented actor as well. And I think he just kind of, you know, he makes the movie work so well.
Patty, I mean, it's what Patty did in that movie, I have so much respect for, because, you know, the other role, Oscar Isaac's role, mm-hmm. is in a sense, you know, it's so much more active and, you know, so much more energetic. And for someone to, you know, get sick on page one,
mm-hmm.
and then have to figure out a way through, you know, the rest of the movie, knowing their fate, he really did just an amazing job of keeping that interesting and really exploring, I think, a lot of emotions that, you know, that the movie needs. I mean, what I always was hoping for when I wrote it was that at the end of the movie, you'd really be pulling for these guys to sell the plutonium. And then on your way home, you go, holy shit.
Yeah.
I was rooting for people to sell plutonium.
Exactly. That's what I thought was so great about the film. But,
great. I'm glad that worked for you, because that was sort of what we were all hoping for. But it was great. I mean, Patty is, he's so talented. I mean, he doesn't work as much as I wish he did.
Yeah, well, he was in The Bourne Ultimatum as well, so you got two.
Yeah, no, I kind of get the assist on that one, because Paul Greengrass had seen P239, and he really liked it. Mm-hmm. And so I said, I can't tell you how amazing Patty is. So I was glad that worked out.
So I know you're busy, so I'm going to get you out of here on this question, which is something I ask pretty much everybody I interview, which is, what's your favorite film, or the film that made you want to make films?
Wow. Can I pick two?
Of course.
I saw them when I was a little kid.
Yeah.
Within a few weeks of each other, or maybe I'm wrong about this, they probably didn't come out that close together, but I think I saw them very close to each other
mm-hmm.
when I was way too young to be seeing these movies, but I saw Dog Day Afternoon and One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, which I think came out in the same year.
Yeah, they both came out in 75, yeah.
Yeah. And so, I was like all of 12 or something at the time when they came out. But I was so, to what you were saying before, I mean, those movies had incredibly funny moments in them, and all these years later, I'm still really moved by what happened, to those guys and the kinds of heroes that, Pacino played, or at least protagonists,
mm-hmm.
and that Nicholson played were these really complicated people, who were, both who were kind of on the outside of the law or of society, but, still had so much to say.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's kind of astonishing to me that all these years later, I still, really love those movies.
Well, it's interesting, because when I saw The Informant, that my first reaction was that this is a film that kind of belongs in the 1970s. When a character like this, who's so flawed, and a film like this that combines elements of comedy and drama, wouldn't seem so out of place. Now it's like a big deal, it's like, you're making a corporate thriller, but it's not a thriller, it's a comedy.
Right. I think Stephen and I both, we're both happy to hear you say that, because I know that, when Stephen is interviewed, people will ask him, what's up with the typeface and the Marvin Hamlish and the, what Stephen will say is, I mean, some of that just happened organically. We didn't really spend a lot of time thinking about that.
Mm-hmm.
But some of it, Stephen will say that he sort of has this fantasy that he's making movies in the 70s because it was such an incredible era. I mean, when you think that both of those movies came out that year.
Exactly.
It's pretty amazing.
Yeah. Well, I wish you the best of luck with The Informant.
Thanks so much.
I hope to see more from you.
Thanks. Well, I hope to make more. And thanks for seeing PU239. I really appreciate it.
Well, thanks for making it.
All right. I'll talk to you soon. Huh?
Thanks a lot.
Bye.
That's it for another podcast. As always, you can email me at noah@moviecitynews.com. Thanks again to Scott Burns. See The Informant. It's a really good movie. And have a good one.